Across America and around the world, you're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. This is the only hour that ever was or ever will be. This is the most important hour in your entire life. For during this hour, you will decide your future and thus our collective future. Welcome back to the Hour of the Time.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's my pleasure.
I understand you've got an intriguing subject to discuss with our listeners tonight.
That's correct. We're going to talk about the Constitution of the United States.
But, Ralph, the Constitution of the United States of America? I mean, doesn't everybody in America understand and know and have a copy of the Constitution?
I can't say that. I don't know if they do or do not, but I don't think many people do, let's say it that way.
I would bet my grandmother's underwear that 98% of the American population not only don't have a copy, but probably never read it unless it was in school during their younger years, and even then they didn't really understand what it was they read, with the exception of most of the audience of the Hour of the Time.
Those people, I would hope, and I appreciate the fact that they have read the Constitution. I think that's magnificent, and perhaps even have a copy that they could get, as we're going to read parts of it ourselves. In fact, we need a copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, so if you want to... those of you who are listening, if you want to get your copy out, please let's do so and get your highlighting pen, because we're going to talk about some very disturbing things that I've discovered in the Constitution and the Declaration that should be brought to your attention. If this is not something new to you, this will be very disturbing. If you already heard it before, it'll help to reinforce it. Please pay attention. This is really something we've all got to understand and consider.
Well, let's go.
Okay. Let's start with the Declaration of Independence. In the second paragraph of the Declaration, that's also dated, by the way, this was, of course, we all know, July the 4th, 1776, our founding fathers decided to declare their independence from the great, the King of Great Britain, England. And so they were using this document to do so. It was called the Declaration of Independence. At the bottom of the second paragraph, it reads as follows. I'm reading now from my copy that I have in my possession at this moment. It says, "The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. So let's start with that now. What they're saying is that King George, the present King of Great Britain, was creating a tyranny in the United States, in fact, over these states. I went back to an 1820-something, I think it was something around 1800 and some, dictionary, and looked up the word tyranny. That's as far back as I could go to 1776, it was maybe 50, 60 years later. And they define tyranny as giving one branch of government or one government total power. So our founding fathers were close to the understanding of tyranny by this dictionary definition maybe 50, 60 years later. I also went back to the Federalist Papers and read the quotes of Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. They also understood what tyranny was. It was giving total power to one government or one branch of government. In fact, in those years, they talked about giving too much power to monarchies, which were, at that time, as perhaps you know, the most prevalent form of government around the world. Now, so what they're saying is that we are now going to establish that we are doing this because the king was establishing a tyranny over us. And then it went on to say, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And then they listed, I think it's 32 specific complaints that they had against the present King of Great Britain in this arena. They were saying, these are the reasons we are breaking away from the present king. And they listed, I think there's 32 of them. The only number I want to bring to your attention is the 22nd one. Those of you, at least in my copy, they're somewhat broken up into short one-sentence paragraphs. Some are maybe more than one. But mine is indented, and I can read the 22nd one. It starts by saying, for suspending our own legislatures. So what they were saying was that King George had dissolved our legislatures, the ones that the founding fathers had created around the various states, and then the Declaration goes on to say, and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. So what they were doing was dissolving our government, our legislatures, creating them all, their own, and then granting those legislatures, quote, the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. That's the key phrase I want you to remember. The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. By definition, giving that government that power is the very definition of tyranny. Our founding fathers were stating that the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever in the hands of a legislature was tyranny. That's why they listed it. We're saying we're going to submit to the candid world the following examples of tyranny in the United States.
What, just for the sake of exploring this, what would be an alternative to that? What would have been the fair thing to do?
What they did in Article 1, Section 8, which we'll cover in a minute. What I want you to get familiar with at this point is that in 1776, our founding fathers declared that the phrase, the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever, was tyranny. Because there is no Magna Carta under the power where they can legislate in all cases whatsoever. Whatever that legislature, that legislative body decides is law, is law. There are no concepts of rights, human rights, inalienable rights, anything under that kind of power. And that's why our founding fathers were separating from King George, the king, as they call it, the present king of Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 11 years later, these same men, basically the same men, wrote the Constitution of the United States. It was later adopted, as you know, in 1789. But it was submitted, I believe, in the first time, 11 years later, in 1786. The Founding Fathers set up three branches of government. Article 1 creates the legislative branch of government. Article 2 creates the executive branch. And Article 3 creates the judicial branch. So we're now going to go to Article 1, wherein our Founding Fathers created the legislative branch of government in a bicameral House and Senate, meaning they have two houses, one House and one Senate. And so they're now going to then grant power to that government in Article 1, Section 8. And you can go to that, if you will, if you've got your copy in front of you. Let's go to Article 1, Section 8, and we'll now read the powers that our founding fathers granted to Congress. Section 8 reads as follows, quote, "The Congress shall have power," and then it starts listing 18 specific grants of power to the federal government, to Congress. The first one reads, "The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, etc., to pay the debts, etc." The next one is the power to borrow money. This is a condensed form, of course. What we're saying is that our founding fathers tried to limit the power of government to the following specified powers, and they listed 18 of them. Now, we, those of us who have studied the Constitution, maybe incorrectly, have decided to call these various grants of power clauses. So I'm going to refer to Article 1, Section 8, Clause, meaning the number 17, meaning the 17th of the 18. We're going to read as follows. Congress shall have the power to, and then this is what it reads, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever.
So in one case, they're saying we're leaving King George because he's doing this, and once we've left King George, we're going to do the same thing.
Exactly. Now notice, Bill, they use the same identical words.
Yes.
In one case, the king had dissolved our governments, our legislatures, and created their own with the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. That was called tyranny. 11 years later, Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, and now it's not tyranny. Something's wrong. It, to me, is just corroboration that our founding fathers intentionally subverted the very document they wrote, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. Now, this is, to further amplify on this is also very important, and that this is a continuation of this very subject. We've got to find out where they gave this power, because our founding fathers created two separate governments in the United States, two distinct separate Congresses. There's only one congressman or one Congress, but they have legislative power over two different governments. Let's go back now to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such districts not exceeding 10 miles square as may by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States. And we're going to stop right there and pause for a moment. So what they're saying is that Congress shall have the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever over the district known as Washington, D.C.
That's right.
And that government, that Congress in this area, shall be running the government of the United States. That's the second problem. What is the government of the United States? It is the government that Congress is running in Washington, D.C. by itself. Now, let's stop right here just for a minute and examine this. We have been told that the cause of the American Revolution was taxation without representation. But here we see that our founding fathers taxed Washington, D.C. without representation, because the people who live in Washington have no congressman, they have no senator. They do vote for president, but they, as far as Congress is concerned, they have no representation. But they are taxed. By whom? Congress. With what power? The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. So we can see that our founding fathers granted this tyrannical power to Congress over the affairs of Washington, D.C. Now, when Congress tries to interfere in the affairs of Arizona or New Mexico or Alaska or any of the other states, it has very specific powers granted to it under Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 16, 18, and the 10th Amendment. Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, to raise an army, etc. Those are all powers that they only have over the states of the 50 states. Those are the powers of the government of the United States of America. But when Congress runs the affairs of Washington, D.C., they call themselves the government of the United States, and they have the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. Now, just as an adjunct to that, let's examine this thought that Congress taxed the people in Washington, D.C. without taxation. In my book,
you mean without representation?
Forgive me, I misstated that. You're right. The power to tax, taxation without representation, which we have been told was the cause of the American Revolution. Bill, in my book, The Unseen Hand, I try to point out that was not the issue in the American Revolution.
Of course not.
The issue was the need to create a central bank that would have the power to create paper money out of nothing and loan it to the government at interest. That's why we fought the issue. This is secondary, but they were creating a government in Washington that was taxing without representation. And so that was not the issue. Now let's continue with our thought. It says to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Now, this is not really germane to our discussion, but long as we're here, let's examine that. Something like over a third of the land in the United States is owned or at least held in the name of the United States government, completely without constitutional authority. Here, they can only build or buy land for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Just today, I drove from Tucson up north, where you live here, Bill, to do this program, and I drove through National Forest. They have no power for National Forest.
That's correct.
I drove through National Parks. They have no power to create National Parks. The only power they have is to buy land for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Now, in some states of the Union, namely this state, Arizona, the state of Hawaii, the truth is that most of the land in those two states, and probably many other states, is actually owned by the federal government residing in Washington, D.C., and that is, in fact, not according to the Constitution.
By the way, on those national parks, what power does Congress have to legislate or activate, whoever it is on those parks? The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. It's a pure tyrannical government. And those on the national forest, they can tell you what to do and not to do. They have complete power to do that. There is no constitution under that power. And you go on your national parks and try to stand up for your Fifth Amendment rights, there is no, they have no, they're not going to recognize your Fifth Amendment rights because you're not, you're acting on their land with the where Congress has the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. Now let's continue our thought. This is the second part of this problem. Let's go now to the 14th Amendment. This is where they pulled the clincher. I like to use the analogy of a fisherman. I'm not a fisherman, but I believe that what you do is you dangle your bait and forget about it until the meaning the hook, the bait with the hook in it, until the fish bites it. As soon as he does, then you pull it and you snag him and then pull him in. So for 70 years, the bait was dangling. Not many people cared about it until the 14th Amendment. Those of you that have your copy of the Constitution, let's flip over to the 14th Amendment. Let's read this.
And by the way, if you don't have a copy of the Constitution, as I've told you before, you really shouldn't be listening to this program unless you just stumbled on it and you don't understand that you really should have a copy of the Constitution. But if you've been listening for a while and you still don't have one, turn your radio off and go to bed. This is not the show for you. Go ahead, Ralph.
I would urge you, in fact, all of us should carry a copy. When you get a copy...
But how can you be an American and not have a copy of the Constitution?
Well, it's just...
I mean, it is America.
Well, okay. Well, I'm trying to say the whole document is written on 3x5 cards, maybe 15 pages. It's very small. You can get a copy very inexpensively. Let's now go to the 14th Amendment, because this is when they pulled the hook, snagged us, and reeled us in. The 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868... after the Civil War, and it reads as follows. We're going to take this. In fact, maybe what I should do is read the whole thing all the way through, and then we'll analyze it part by part. Let's do that. It says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Let's just read that now step by step. First of all, they notice that they are now calling us persons. We used to be called people, and I'm not an expert in this particular field, but there is a reason that they stopped calling us people,
yes.
And we're now called persons. And what goes on to say, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. Now, let's stop there and analyze that. What does that mean? Where is the United States? It's only Washington, D.C.
That's right.
It's not the state of Alaska, not the state of Arizona. It's not the combination of those two states or all the other 50 states. Those are called the small U, United, right? Capital S, States of America. So what we're talking about then is Washington, D.C. all persons born in Washington, D.C. Now let's take that step. The second part, which is a person, the first part rather, is a person born there who was born in Washington, D.C., is ruled by a Congress with the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever, and he's now called a citizen of the United States because he was born in Washington, D.C. But they also included a second group of citizens, those who are naturalized in the United States. Now, what is a naturalized citizen? A naturalized citizen is one who renounces his citizenship in another jurisdiction, another foreign state, a foreign nation, whatever. Someone, let's say, from France who comes to America, gives up his French citizenship, and becomes a citizen of the United States.
Or somebody from Oklahoma.
Well, Bill, don't get ahead of
or
me.
Or Michigan.
Don't get ahead of me, Bill, please. Let's keep it simple. Let's go back here. What I'm trying to point out is a naturalized citizen is one who voluntarily requests to become a citizen of that government, right? A person from France decides to move to America. He wants to become a citizen of the United States. How does he do that? Voluntarily. Okay? So right. Now we've got two classes of people in Washington, D.C. who are citizens of the United States. Let's go back. It says all persons born in the United States are all persons naturalized in the United States. Now, are we a naturalized citizen of the United States? Now, before you answer, Bill, I know what you're going to say. Don't get ahead of me here. Please be patient.
I'm keeping my mouth shut.
Let's go back. Did we, the American people who live in Michigan, who were not born in Washington, D.C., are we a naturalized citizen of the United States? Yes. How did we do that? Voluntarily, by accepting the Social Security card. Now, let's go slow here, Bill. Let's make sure these people understand what we're talking about. There is no law requiring a citizen of the state of Arizona or any other of the 50 states. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires you to get a Social Security card.
That's correct.
And the reason they can't make you do that is because they have no jurisdiction over you.
That's correct.
And the reason they have no jurisdiction over you is because you've not given them jurisdiction. At least if you're not born in Washington, D.C., I'm going to take my own case. I was born in Tucson, Arizona. So I was not born in Washington, D.C., therefore I'm not a citizen of the United States, but I am a naturalized citizen of the United States by accepting my Social Security card. And you say, wait a minute, Ralph, I was told I had to get a card, and I'm still waiting for the person who's done that to show me where in law he's required to get a Social Security card. He's not. Why? Because you are not a citizen of the United States. You are a citizen of the state of Arizona, Alabama, Michigan, whatever it is, and you have been tricked into getting a Social Security card because you believe you had to.
That's right.
Now, let me tell
you. How did this happen, Ralph?
Well, you're getting out of here. Let me tell one more little story here. I have a friend of mine who just maybe a couple of years ago wanted to have another child to add to his family. He had now learned this point about being a naturalized citizen subject to the jurisdiction of the federal government. He decided not to have his child in the normal traditional way through the hospitals. He learned he's a Christian, and so he and his wife decided to have their child through natural childbirth, not even seeking a doctor, turning the child over in prayer to God. If God wants a healthy child, he'll produce one. They decided to go through this. They learned the Lamaze thing, all the techniques. He learned how to become a midwife himself, to have the child naturally. At the last minute, they had a complication. I don't know what. That's not really pertinent to the story. But in any event, he debated whether to go to the hospital. He went to the hospital. They delivered the child naturally. Fortunately, both mother and daughter are doing fine. Now the child's 2 or 3 years old. But they were told they had to get a Social Security card or they couldn't get their child out of the hospital. That's what they tried to avoid, and they weren't able to succeed.
Ralph, they did the same thing to us when Pooh was born, when we refused to fill out and sign the birth certificate.
Yes.
They told us we could not take our child home. And I'm telling you right now, that hospital has never seen a ruckus like I raised on that day And the outcome of it was we did take her home.
Without
signing, without filling out, without any of the things that they required us to do.
Yeah.
Now, it was not easy, and we had no idea what was going to happen.
Okay.
But we also understood that without signing that document, they could not take that child. We knew that.
Yes.
If we had signed that document and then refused to fill any of it out, then they could have.
And let's go back now. What Bill is just saying is further amplification and further proof of what I'm contending here. Let's go back now to the 14th Amendment. It says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states wherein they reside. So now, if you get a Social Security card, you now have joint citizenship. You're a citizen of the state of Arizona or Michigan or Alabama and the citizen of the United States. Now, what Bill is pointing out is that what he was asked to do was to place his daughter under the jurisdiction of the government of the United States by signing the whatever the form was.
That's correct.
The birth certificate. The birth certificate is used as a voluntary acceptance or giving, if you will, of your child to the government so that that government has jurisdiction over that child. You do that voluntarily. Now, Bill did not do it voluntarily. He was able to get his daughter out without the birth certificate.
But that's only because I'd done a lot of studying, and I understood what was happening there. Most people don't. They have no idea what they're doing. They have no idea what they're doing or giving up when they go in and sign the documents and take out a Social Security number. But most people do that through fraud. They're told that they have to get a Social Security number, and they're usually told that by an employer who says, you can't go to work here unless you have a Social Security number. What people don't understand is they don't have to get a Social Security number, and the employer has no right to make that a condition of employment, and if he does, you have the right to sue him.
That's correct. So what we've got here, Bill, is we have been tricked and deceived.
That's correct.
By whom? Our founding fathers and those who wrote the 14th Amendment.
But they knew that in the beginning when they talked about this as being the, quote, great experiment, unquote. And they talked in all of their correspondence and their letters, they knew that we would not be able to keep our sovereignty or keep our Creator-endowed rights under the protection of the Constitution. And they talked about the fact that the people will give it away in exchange for some benefit.
Okay. That's exactly right. What you just said is true. Now, let's go back to what Bill just tried to say. I'll say it in my language, just as amplification of what Bill said. What he just said was that we have given away our sovereignty over ourselves for a benefit. What benefit? The Social Security provisions later on in our life. They've tricked us with what they call the bait and switch thing. They've given us this promise of great, of taking care of us in our old age if we will give up our sovereignty as citizenships.
Right. And this has its roots in the common law, where the common law says that anyone who accepts a benefit from someone else gives up their freedom because the person bestowing the benefit has the right to determine how the benefit is going to be used.
Yes. Okay, now let's take one of the most commonly common challenges to what we just said. They said, wait a minute, Ralph, come on, let's get back to Article 1, Section 8. You'll read here that Congress only has these certain powers. It doesn't have this broad power you say it does. And let's go back to Article 1, Section 8, and we'll read just parts once again of these grants of power that those who claim that this is all constitutional, what they're doing even today is constitutional. And let's go back to the powers that our founding fathers granted Congress. Like the power to lay and collect taxes, to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to establish naturalization laws, I'm abbreviating these, to coin money, punish counterfeiters, post offices, etc. And then it says it has the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. So they've got the power to make an army and then enforce the army because it's constitutional. So that makes sense. So those who say, wait a minute, Ralph, this here must be an error because what our government is doing is constitutional. It's all listed there somehow. I love to ask them this question. If our government operates on specified powers listed 1 through 16, 18, and the 10th Amendment, which we'll cover in a minute, where did Congress get the power to tax us to build a space telescope. We'll talk about that if we get through the break.
Okay, you guys keep that thought, remember that, and we'll talk about that as soon as we come back. But right now, it's time to take our break, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short pause. Hello, folks. That break didn't take very long, and those of you who are in tune with this show know exactly what I'm going to talk about now. My question to you is this. If you have not yet taken steps to fulfill your responsibility to your family and to yourself by investigating the possibilities that are available to protect your assets, everything that you've worked for all your life, against what we know is coming very shortly in the future, then I want to know, what's holding you up? Why haven't you done this? What is wrong with you? Are you going to be the person sitting on the corner when I walk by, crying your eyes out, saying, somebody's picking on me because I've lost everything that I had because of inflation, economic collapse, depression, all of the things that we're expecting to happen? Now, recently, Mr. Greenspan, and you know who he is, if you don't, again, you're listening to the wrong program, testified in front of Congress on C-SPAN. If you were watching it, you heard him say that they could no longer hold inflation in check, that they were expecting, more or less, runaway inflation. And they're expecting it very soon. What happens in inflation? The value of the dollar declines, which means whatever you own loses value, and in order to buy a loaf of bread, you must have more dollars to buy the same loaf of bread that less dollars would have bought a week before. Now, if you understand history, and if you understand the relation of inflation to hard assets, gold and silver, then you know that you should be on the phone right this moment, because I'm going to play some music in just a couple of seconds here, and you've got time to do it. You should be on the phone to Swiss America Trading asking for information. You owe it to yourself, and if you're a listener to this show, if you derive real worth from the hour of the time, then you owe some loyalty to Swiss America Trading, because they pay for this airtime. None of the money goes in my pocket. That's not the purpose of this show. The money they spend pays for this airtime because they believe in the hour of the time. They believe in the message that we're putting out to the world. So get up off your butt right now and call 1-800-289-2646. Don't procrastinate. Don't mess around. I don't want to hear you crying. And if I do, I won't have any sympathy for you. You all know me by now. I'm trying to get you moving. I'm trying to get you prepared. I'm trying to wake up the sheeple, empower the people, and save freedom for the world. Call now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Tell them that you listen to this program, The Hour of the Time. Mention my name, William Cooper, and you'll receive a free newsletter on protecting your future. Call now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Folks, by protecting your future, you're helping to protect the future of this radio broadcast, The Hour of the Time, and Freedom for the World. Call now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646, and you'll be glad that you did. Get back into the program, folks. I want to let you know that Ralph has done an awful lot to help wake the sheeple, empower the people, and save freedom for the world, just like I've been doing. And I'm using sort of my cause to promote his, because we are brothers on the battlefield, and you can be too. Let me just give you some of the things that Ralph has to offer. He has a 33-page booklet entitled Clinton's Conspiracy. Bill Clinton supports it. The driver shot Kennedy. And folks, you've heard about that on this program, a two-hour video cassette. The Unseen Hand, one of the best primers to get you acquainted with the conspiracy. 488 pages, ladies and gentlemen, of some of the best research that I've ever seen into the conspiratorial history of the world. And then he wrote another book called The New World Order, which you've heard me quote extensively during our series on the mystery schools. That's a 388-page book, and I'm telling you, if you read that book and research the references that he has given, and you still believe Freemasonry is just a fraternal organ existing for the good of the community, then I've got to tell you, you've lost your mind. God exists. There is no other option. 26-page booklet. The Kennedy Assassination, Conspiracy and Cover-Up, another two-hour video. Vietnam, America's Betrayal and Treason, two videotapes, 3 hours of lectures, and a 93-page booklet. The Kennedy Assassination in Vietnam, set of three videotapes. You know, a lot of this you've heard on this program. Now, don't get me wrong, folks. Ralph Everson does not agree with everything that I have discovered in my research, and I certainly don't agree with everything that he's discovered. But I'll tell you this. I think we probably concur and agree on about 90% of what each and the other has uncovered and is trying to alert people to. But you know that's not the purpose of this broadcast. The purpose of this broadcast is wake you up, get you to do your own research, to teach you that you can think for yourself, and nobody has to tell you what the truth is if you will just learn that you are the ultimate, penultimate, if you will, power in the United States of America, and that you have to learn to think for yourself. And if you can't, you're just a puppet on somebody's string. And when they pull that string, as you've heard me say a million times, you're going to dance. Is that what you want to be? No, of course not. You know, there's a lot of other things. This is a pretty extensive catalog here, and you need to get it. Write us with a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send you this catalog, just 29-cent self-addressed, stamped, number 10 envelope. Send it to this address, folks. Ralph. Just send it to Ralph. You don't need to remember anything else. Ralph, P.O. Box 536. P.O. Box 536. Tucson, Arizona. For those of you who haven't been out west here, Tucson is spelled T-U-C-S-O-N. Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, Ralph, Post Office Box 536, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. I'll repeat this toward the end of the program. I'll also put it on the hotline. So if you missed it tonight, you can call the hotline tomorrow and get this address. Now, Ralph Efferson, my good friend, has consented to help out what we're doing here by giving us a small percentage of whatever you order from his catalog. So whenever you order from his catalog, please specify that you're ordering from the offers through the catalog after you get it through the mail from listening to the hour of the time. And that will help us out here. It will help Ralph out. And with this fantastic research that he's done, it's going to do more than help you out, folks. It's going to get you up out of that easy chair, off the couch potato status, and into action to help us save this great nation of ours. Let's get back to what we were talking about, Ralph. We left off. You were
posing a question.
That's right. You were posing a question, and the audience out there has been thinking about it.
Okay.
Let's get right back to it.
Let's get back to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the United States, and let's examine the powers of Congress that they have over the rest of the Union, meaning the states of the 50 states in the United States of America. Those powers are specified in this document. Like I said before, the power to coin money, to establish post offices, promote science, to declare war, raise and support armies, provide and maintain an army, etc., a navy, etc. These are all spelled out. And then the 10th Amendment says something to the effect that, in fact, I'll read it, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states, or reserved to the states respectively, or to the people, which means if we didn't give you the power, you don't have it. So those who say, wait a minute, Ralph, I'm sure that when Congress takes this action, it's all constitutional, I'd love to ask them this question. If this is true, where did our founding fathers list the power to tax the American people to build a space telescope? The Hubble Space Telescope, orbiting the Earth right now, was built with taxpayers' money.
Never mind that it doesn't work.
But where did Congress, where did our founding fathers envision such a thing? If you could play Buck Rogers and go back to the founding of the nation, and when they were writing the Constitution, say, gentlemen, I'm from your future. I want you to empower Congress to have the power to tax the American people to build a space telescope. They would have said, what? What is a space telescope? You mean space meaning something in the air someplace? You're going to get something up here, it'll fall to the ground. And what is a space telescope? What is a telescope? We mean something that's going to take pictures or look at things? What are you talking about? They would have had no idea. Our founding fathers could never have envisioned such a thing as a space telescope. But ladies and gentlemen, you and I, and we all know it's there. How did it do it? Under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. It's a constitutional grant of power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. They decided they wanted to do it, and they did it.
But that's just for those who are maybe confused out there, it's the power to legislate in all cases, but only within the geographical boundaries and over those citizens of that area called Washington, D.C., and property that has been deeded and ceded and owned by them constitutionally. Is that correct?
Well, except, that's true, except with one more comma, a naturalized citizen who's given them the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever.
Correct.
And that's you and I. That's the point I want to make. We have given them our sovereignty to Congress under this grant of power. We have now become a naturalized citizen of that government, and the power they have over us in our state of Arizona, wherever we live, is the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. That means that they can tax us to build a space telescope because we've given them that power under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. You could list probably 90% of what the federal government's doing today and argue where is that listed in the Article 1, Section 8, the remainder of the section.
Now, we know, and our forefathers argued, that the rights that we have are not rights granted by the Constitution, but are creator-endowed rights.
Correct.
Now, if they're creator-endowed rights, how in the world could we give them up? I mean, how do you give up something that was given to you by God?
Well, you can see, we can do that. You can give up your rights to God if you choose. That's what they're saying. Your rights are inalienable. Only you can give them up, or God can take them away. Government has no power to take them away, and they didn't take them away, Bill. You gave them. I don't mean you maybe personally, but let's say you collectively, all of us, we gave up our inalienable rights because we have the power to do that. They belong to us.
Well, not really give them. We don't have the power to give them up, but we have another power that was also given to us, was granted as not being taken away from us in the Constitution. We have the right to contract.
Okay.
And that is, in effect, really what we're doing. We're
okay.
Contracting those rights away.
Okay, I won't argue. We're both saying the same thing. You're saying that the right to contract, they've asked us to form a contract with the government.
That's right.
And when we did that, we thought we had to form the contract by getting our Social Security card.
Yeah, I hope you don't misunderstand. I'm not trying to nitpick with you, but there's a lot of people out there that don't understand what we're talking about. And what I'm trying to do is focus in so that where I might understand it, and you understand it, and both of us sitting here know exactly what we're talking about, there's somebody out there shaking their head and saying, what do you say?
Okay, let's take the next step about this, and then I want to get into Ross Perot.
Okay.
Let's talk briefly about this grant of power that we've given them. One of the other things that we've given them is the power to tax us under the income tax. The income tax is voluntary. Have you talked about this in the past on your program?
Oh, have I talked about it? Have I talked about it, folks? Let me hear. I want to hear the yell all across. Let's hear the big cheer all across the country. Boy, have we talked about
it. Okay, let's talk about, for those who have never heard this before, or let's reinforce it again so that they make it abundantly clear, there is no power to tax us directly under the basic Constitution of the United States of America.
In fact, the Constitution specifically forbids a direct tax.
That's correct.
And specifies exactly the taxes that can be levied and exactly how and only how they can be levied.
That's absolutely correct. Now, how then do they have the power to tax us on our incomes?
Very simple. We get our little W-4 form, and we check United States citizen. Okay. We fill out how many exemptions we have.
Social Security exemptions.
And we put down our Social Security number, and we list our dependents, and we send this thing in, and we have now contracted to pay voluntarily a direct income tax, which is forbidden by the Constitution in any other way.
That's correct. Do you understand what I'm trying to point out? There's one more example of this
that
I can think of, and that is the. In fact, we got one more. Let's talk about the postage stamp. Let's go back now to the draft. Now, I don't remember this because I was not drafted, but when I joined the reserves years ago. I don't remember going through this ceremony. Maybe you can help me, Bill. I have been. Told,
I wasn't drafted either. I was so stupid.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's go back to.
I hadn't learned yet.
Maybe you can remember the ceremony you went through, but I have been told, I cannot confirm this, it didn't happen to me, I don't remember this, but during that ceremony, were you not asked to take one step forward?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, what was that for?
If you're a United States citizen.
You were volunteering.
That's
volunteering.
Right.
You were volunteering to take one step forward to give them give the Army the jurisdiction over you.
First thing that I remember is they ask if there was anybody in the room who was not a United States citizen.
Yes.
Those people, if there were any, were asked to step aside.
Yes.
Everybody else was asked to take one step forward, raise their right hand, and repeat after me.
The purpose of the one step forward is for you to voluntarily give up your sovereignty to the federal government and to the jurisdiction thereof under this power to them, the government. That's what they do it for. It's a voluntary act. They said voluntary. They even mentioned it.
That's correct. Now, there's something else about this that I've since learned. If they send you a draft notice and say you have to report for a physical and for induction into the United States military service on such and such a day because your number is such and such, you must do that. There's no way that you can get out of doing that. Whether you're a conscientious objector or what, you have to make that known there. But you must report, you must go through the physical, you must go through the process. But what I've learned is no one at any time ever can force you to sign your name on any document or to raise your hand and take an oath.
That's great.
And anyone who refused to sign their name or refused to take the oath was sent home.
That's right.
And was not inducted into the military service. And everybody was coming up with these unbelievable excuses and reasons and masquerading as if they were homosexuals and trying to get out of being drafted when all they had to do was refuse to take the oath and they could not have been drafted.
So, well, but the point is very clear. Once again, it's for further evidence that I believe our contentions are correct. They are getting you to volunteer to submit yourself to the jurisdiction of the United States government by stepping forward voluntarily.
I think it's a tremendous evidence that they are extremely crafty and cunning and slick and tricky and that we really aren't exercising the mental powers that we should be when we're dealing with these people.
Okay, let me give you one.
We must be on our guard all the time.
That's correct. Let me give you one more example of this that occurs to me. There might be others that maybe some of your listeners might have. They could get in touch with you or somehow. But let's go to number four. Example number four is the use of the postage stamp. I have been told, in fact, I've done this myself, you can mail between the 50 states under what they call non-domestic mail for 2 cents a half ounce. And I have seen it work repeatedly. Now, by the way, I want to make it clear, I'm not recommending you do that or suggested that, but if you want to know more about this, write to me at the P.O. Box Bill gave you, to Ralph Epperson, or just Ralph, and say, tell me more about this the mail thing, but let me take one more last step. There is, when you write mail to Washington, D.C., it's called domestic mail, and you have to pay the 29 cents or the half ounce, wherever it is, or the ounce. But if you mail inside the United States, those are the United States of America, the 50 states, it's only 2 cents, half an ounce, and the post office is accepting this stuff without question, even today.
From like Tucson, Arizona to Birmingham,
yes,
Alabama.
2 cents a half ounce, because it's inside the United States of America.
That's
right. It's not going to a foreign nation, a foreign government called the government of the United States.
And it's also called drop mail, isn't it?
I don't know about
something
that.
Like that.
Could be. But if you want to know some details on that, just drop me a note in at the P.O. box Bill gave you, and I'll give you some further details. This
yeah,
is really
I've got to warn you, though, it doesn't work all the time. I have been, and I did this, by the way, when I lived in Camp Verde. Somebody sent me a non-domestic letter with a 2 cent stamp on it. When I went to the post office, I found this little yellow slip in my box. I went up and handed it to them. They said, oh, you have 27 cents postage due. And I looked at it. It was clearly labeled non-domestic mail. It had the law clearly stated, and it had a 2 cent stamp on it as required by law. And I said, I'm not going to pay 27 cents. I want my mail. And if you refuse to give me my mail, I'm going to sue you for interfering with the delivery of my mail under the law, which is a felony. And this really created quite a consternation because they didn't know what to do. They didn't want to be sued. They didn't want to be charged with a felony. And they didn't want to be liable for interfering with my mail. At the same time, this letter had been intercepted by a postal inspector who had directed them to collect 27 cents. Well, what eventually happened was that I filed suit in small claims court for 27 cents.
Hmm.
And the post office paid me my 27 cents.
Well, there's a friend of mine, and I will not name him on your program, Bill, if you don't mind.
That's okay.
But I have a friend of mine who tells me that he's got the papers that you used and the procedures you used to object, as you've done, so maybe not in the same procedure, but to guarantee that you get your mail for 2 cents. So once again, if you want to know about this, drop me a note, the P.O. box Bill will give you. Now let's talk now about this individual by the name of Ross Perot running around the United States talking about we the people being the power of this government. If I may, I'd like to start with the example of Ross Perot, who spoke in Tucson, Arizona, just about maybe 3-4 weeks ago, something like that. He came to our city. It was advertised as an open speech, so a lot of us went to hear him. After he got through with the amenities of saying how nice it was to be in Tucson and what a great group he looked like, and you know, he's buttering us up for his campaign run maybe in 2 or 3 more years, the first words out of his mouth were, "We are the boss." That's his lesson. He's telling us we are the boss. And I started to almost cry because I said, Ross, under that kind of... I was not able to ask him this question. There was 2,500 of us in the auditorium.
Yeah, but we know what you mean. You were thinking that. You wanted to ask him, right?
You bet. If I could have... In fact, I even told you that he was standing up and challenging him, even getting thrown out to make my point. We are not the boss. Let's go back. What is the purpose of the Constitution, Ross Perot? If we are the boss and we decide in all things, who needs a Constitution? What's the purpose of the Constitution? To limit government, period.
That's right.
So Ross Perot saying, we don't need the Constitution. We shall decide in all things. And let's take the second thing. Ross Perot's advocated during the campaign of 1992 that all of us be given or buy or somehow get a little electronic device. He wants to, if he was president, he'd get on the air and tell us, here's the problem we've got, and here's these suggested solutions, 2 or 3, and you can push a button for which one you want to do, and then when we all decide together, the majority sides, that's what we'll do. That's the way to do it.
And which tenet of the Communist Manifesto is that?
Go ahead, which one?
It's the one called One Man, One Vote.
One vote.
This is a republic. Democracy is a code word for socialism. And if you really want one man, one vote, and you want the people to decide everything by a popular vote, you have no idea what a can of worms and what kind of oppression you're going to open up. Because whoever is the majority will get rid of the rest. Whoever wants the greatest number that wants something from the government is going to get it. And whenever that happens, what usually transpires is the majority votes itself everything until there's nothing left, and a dictator has to stand up to clean up the mess and take charge.
Well,
there are plenty of examples of that throughout history.
Two things I'd like to comment about Ross Perot. Number one, I would have loved to have asked him this question. He believes that we are the boss. Let me ask him this question. I live in Tucson, which is part of Pima County, which is probably 3/4 desert and 1/4, houses and buildings and cities. So let's just presume, in our little example, that during this Ethiopian famine, our government benevolently decided to help these people. Let's just make it 500,000 of them. And they moved them to Pima County because it's similar to terrain, desert, and they gave them water and everything they needed to survive.
Yeah, they go from a place where there's no food to a place where there's no water. That makes sense to me. Remind me to ask you why you're living there, Ralph.
in my example, they even give them the water bill. So come on, these people are now able to survive in Pima County. And let's just say that after 5 years, they become naturalized citizens, the majority. And let's just say that of the 500,000, 400,000 were adults able to vote, let's say. And they went to the county government and said, listen, we are now the majority in Pima County, and we want to make cannibalism legal. Ross, what's the answer? We are the people. We are the boss. The majority of the people in Pima County would make cannibalism legal in Pima County.
Sure.
Ross, we're the boss.
Or we don't like blacks, let's kill them all.
Yeah. Ross, what is to prevent that from happening? The Constitution of the United States.
That's correct.
Why? Because the Constitution says Congress shall pass no law restricting man's right, his inalienable right, to life, liberty, and property. Notice what happened. If we advocate what Ross Perot is advocating and we support him, we've lost the Constitution because we, the people, will start making laws that violate the rights of individuals.
Well, he has said on many, many occasions, not just one, but many occasions, that the Constitution is old, it's outdated. It was created over 200 years ago by a bunch of old men who were not acquainted with the problems of the modern day and could not have foreseen these problems. And that the system doesn't work, and that we have to completely redo the whole system. He is advocating a constitutional convention to redo the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. All of these people are leaving out the part that the Constitution is a living document. It can never be too old or outdated, and the fact that it is not being changed or has not been changed means that the procedure that's set into place whereby we can change it if it's necessary has not been called forth because we don't believe that it's outdated, we don't believe that it needs to be changed, and we don't want anybody messing with it. So who really is Ross Perot?
Well, maybe we'll answer that towards the end of the program. Let me tell you what we did in Tucson about Ross Perot's appearance at the University of Arizona auditorium. I printed up a flyer, one-page flyer, just very brief. I said, Ross Perot balanced the budget by enforcing the Constitution. And I listed on that sheet of paper the 18 grants of power, actually 17. I deleted Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and asked Ross Perot to enforce the Constitution and eliminate government, at least parts of it. Thanks very much.
Fantastic. Ralph, I want to thank you for being our special guest tonight. Again, folks, send for this catalog. You've got to read, you have got to, absolutely, you've got to read The Unseen Hand and his other book, The New World Order, which I have quoted from many times on this program. It is a must for anybody who's trying to understand what's going on in the world today. Send for this catalog, send a self-addressed, stamped, size number 10 envelope to Ralph. Post Office Box 536, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's Ralph. Post Office Box 536, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. And whenever you order something out of that catalog, folks, tell them that you're ordering it from the shows that you heard on the Hour of the Time, and Ralph would share a small portion of the money that you send in with our efforts here so that we can continue to bring you the information that we do. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you.